I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. So tell me if this sounds nuts, or, I don't know, maybe familiar, but I have this weird resistance to the holidays. Like, I love them, but every year, when we start heading into the season, I always feel like it's coming too fast, I want to put it off, and I'm never ready for them. A couple years ago, I remember hearing Christmas carols right after Halloween, and I was furious. Well, you can't procrastinate anymore, though, because it's on. We had Thanksgiving, and Hanukkah is so close, I can already smell the oil. So we're going to start there today. My buddy David Nayfeld is a terrific chef. His restaurant is called Ke Fico in San Francisco, and it's an Italian restaurant with a focus on the food of the Roman ghetto. So he was in New York recently to be named one of Bon Appetit magazine's best new restaurants of the year, and while he was in town, he dropped by my place to show me how his family does potato pancakes. Chef David Nayfeld, how are you?
I'm doing very well, Francis.
It is a pleasure to have you. So most of the guests at the Splendid Table do not actually make house calls. So thank you for coming to my home. So you are not Italian. You studied cooking in Italy. You're a great student of Italian cooking, but you're also super interested in Italian Jewish food. Tell me about it.
Jewish food has always been something that I've been incredibly fascinated with because, you know, the diaspora of Jewish cuisine is vast, right? Yeah. You know, they were a traveling people, very nomadic. So between, Ashkenazi and Sephardic and the silk trade and, you know, persecution and going from one town to another, one country to another, one continent to another, they pick up things where they were and then bring them to their new place. And then history, right? You have, for example, in our restaurant, it's the Cucina Ibrica, which is, you know, the Jewish cuisine of Rome, which, you know, kind of found its fame, so to speak, in the Roman ghetto, which is the longest existing ghetto in the world.
Yeah.
You know, the history of that cuisine is not one that is not still growing, right? So you have people who have come to Rome at different decades and centuries and millennia, essentially, that brought different things from different areas, right? So you had some that were coming from North Africa and some that were coming down from the Veneto, from Venice, and bringing those different kind of traditions that they've created for themselves and then creating new traditions, right?
Right.
And, you know, these were all things that at the restaurant we wanted to showcase. So today, one of the recipes that I wanted to point out was how different even the sphere of the idea of the potato pancake can be the latke, right? When you think of latkes, everybody has an opinion of what they think a latke is to them. You know, a lot of times people here in New York might envision like Veselka, right? It's like a shredded latke.
Yeah, it's like a shredded crispy potato pancake, right?
Yeah, totally like that. And so the potato pancake I grew up eating was from, you know, my family that immigrated here as refugees from Belarus. So it's actually not called a latke, it's called a dranik.
Okay.
So so draniki are, you know, ground potatoes rather than shredded.
Yeah.
And so they have more moisture to them, like a potato batter. And on the inside is this like beautifully ground chicken patty that has, you know, a certain amount of chicken fat in it and some herbs and some garlic. And it's super flavorful. And getting closer to the holidays now, you know, I always think about this recipe because it's reminiscent for me of being in my home and coming home to like a massive stack of these draniki just sitting there, and you just run up to the stove and you grab one. It's not your stereotypical one-trick pony latke.
Right. All right. This is at least a two-trick pony.
It's at least two tricks.
All right. So let's take a look. We're going to make it now.
Right.
So we tried to do some prep for you before you showed up. I have the eggs beaten. I've got the chicken mixed with the garlic and the parsley. Ground potatoes.
Right. If you don't have a grinder, what you can do is you can shred them first and then put them into a food processor and just kind of pulse them slightly. And it's wet, right? You have, you know, it's almost batter-esque, right?
Yeah.
And so instead of draining it out, what we're going to do is we're going to thicken it. And the idea behind thickening it rather than draining it is all of that wetness, that has flavor, and that's also going to add to the kind of moisture on the inside of the dranik. So we're going to add some flour and some eggs to this. You know, there's a recipe for this, but the fact that this recipe is even written down, I think, is going to like revoke my Jew pass. You know, because we wrote down nothing in my family. Unfortunately, my grandparents passed away before I was able to take the type of interest that I really should have in the things that they could pass down. Mm-hmm. I'm actually very fortunate because my mom's husband is actually a really amazing cook, and he's kind of like carried the mantle. Is that like a saying? Carried the mantle? Carried the mantle. Carried the flag.
Carried the torch.
The flag, the torch.
What do you do
like
with
that.
A mantle? I don't really know what a mantle is. Yeah, my wife's an architect. She knows.
You don't like. You didn't grow up in like a rich household where
with
there were mantles.
Fireplace and
like,
mantles?
Yeah, no. Neither did I. So yeah. we're out of our league here, Francis. kids with ethnic backgrounds didn't have mantles. All right. So either way, whatever. He passed the latke, yeah. You know, so to speak. And you know, he's the one who really showed me how to make this, and it was kind of like a special bonding experience between he and I, where you know he showed me the way that his mother taught him how to make it.
Yeah.
So we're going to add some of the flour here into the ground potato and onion, which already is seasoned with salt and pepper. And we're going to add just enough to kind of thicken it a bit. Now, whenever you add flour to something, you really want to be careful not to overwork it, right? Because then you kind of get that like gluten elasticity that you don't want in this case. So now we have our broken eggs. So we're mixing the batter together. So by the end of it, the way it should appear is the water should look as if it's been thickened into the batter.
Mm-hmm.
And it should not appear that there
it's
is like
any water has seeping up the top.
Exactly right. We have our ground chicken here, and that's mixed with some chopped parsley, some egg, some garlic, as well as some salt and pepper.
So the oven is preheated. It's 400 degrees, as asked for in your written recipe.
Oh, thank you. Perfect. And so we have a nonstick or a well-seasoned cast iron skillet. You could try to do this with a pan. Just the idea is like make sure that the pan gets hot first and then you get your oil hot first.
Yeah.
Add a generous amount of oil to this. So we're going to take our potato batter and make sure that it has been slightly mixed so that way there's no kind of water right on top. And we're going to take a spoonful and we're going to put it right in the center, and then maybe another quarter spoonful. And we're going to create a little divot right in the center.
Okay.
Not a hole all the way to the bottom, but yeah. Just the smallest little divot.
Yeah, just gently pushing the center out with the back of your spoon.
Exactly right. And then from there, what we're going to do is we're going to take our chicken, our ground chicken, we're going to put
yes
right in the center there like that, and then right after we're gonna take another smaller spoonful and put it right on
the batter. So you're just covering up that little chicken, patty with more of this potato batter.
Yeah, exactly right. So if you notice, you're getting like this beautiful kind of
this
golden
really nice
brown,
crispy brown edge around the side.
So this, to me, the smell that you're smelling right now, that's my childhood.
Yeah.
Like everything about that is my childhood. You know, ground onion, ground potato, ground chicken with like chicken fat and onions and garlic.
And this would be like a holiday food for you. Like this would be like a Hanukkah food.
Yeah, totally. 100%. And if you wanted to do it without meat, by the way, you could totally do this very same recipe without meat. And it would be just as good. You just wouldn't have the meat. And sometimes you'll run out of meat. And basically what my mom's husband will do is he just keeps cooking with a potato.
Yeah.
And then he'll have some with meat and some without. So at this point, we're going to do a kind of move here where I'm going to turn the fire off. The oil's still hot. And we're going to go to flip this. And what I do is I take the pan and I tilt the pan away from me. And then what I'll do is I'll flip it towards the part of the pan that has less oil in it so
yeah.
It doesn't splash all over the place.
Yeah.
Okay, and then I'll let it back down.
Oh, that is pretty. And oh, that is like the most beautiful golden brown circle of potato.
Yeah, totally. And then at this point, once you get like really nice color on both sides, like you see how at the bottom there it's yeah. Nice and golden brown and crispy.
Yeah.
I'm gonna pull it out and I'm gonna put it on a tray that's lined with something. It can be lined with foil or parchment paper or a silpat or anything like that. And then we're just gonna put them in the oven. Bake for about 3 minutes or so, 4 minutes, and then we'll check it when the time has come to see if it's hot in the center.
Magic radio moment. So now this is coming out of the oven and it's definitely puffed in the middle.
Yeah, and so that, you know, the steam is escaping from the inside and then What I like to do first is we'll put it onto a paper towel as it comes out to kind of soak up any excess oil that there is left. And I'm just going to flip it over just to get both sides. And then I'm going to take it and just put it on a plate.
Just keep doing your demo, chef. I'm going to sit here and keep cooking.
Okay, you got it. So I like to finish with just a little bit of extra salt on top. If you want to get fancy, you can use some fleur de sel or even flake salt. Or you can just finish with just a little bit more kosher. And so what I'm going to do is we have some applesauce here and some sour cream. So now what we're going to do is we're going to take a generous dollop of sour cream, put it to one side, and then on the other side, we're going to take a nice dollop of applesauce, line them up right next to each other in any proportion that you prefer to, but I'm a more applesauce than sour cream type of person. Now there's one thing that I'm going to do to kind of chef this up slightly, and this is something I started doing. This was never done in my household, so feel free to skip this. I take some sliced chives, and I just really finish the top with a good amount, like a mound. You know, and potatoes, sour cream, and chives, that's not like a stretch, right?
Yeah. Okay. It smells so good coming out. I mean, like, it's that crisp potato. You can really smell that chicken. Yeah. You can really smell that chicken coming through it.
So just...
All right. I'm kind of more of a sour cream guy, so I'm going to start on the sour cream side, if that's all right with you.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. To each their own. And I'm more of a applesauce type fellow myself, so I'm going to go in there on this side. This is just something for me that's always been there, right? You know, you've always had this constant of coming back home and this flavor and this smell. And it's something I'm looking forward to sharing with my daughter.
Yeah.
You know, it's her experience of coming in from a cold day outside and smelling, you know, much to my girlfriend's chagrin, some, you know, oil like permeating through the apartment and potatoes searing in the pan and the chicken fat smell. But, you know, for me, when my daughter smells that, I think she's going to associate it the same way I do with this, just this feeling of comfort, like this feeling of, you know, someone who loves you is at home cooking for you, you know, and it's a beautiful thing.
That's awesome.
I'm going to take another bite.
Thank you so much for coming over and cooking this for me and giving me your family memory for me to give to my kid.
I appreciate it, man. Thanks for having me here.
Happy Hanukkah.
Thank you very much.
David Nayfeld is the chef of K Fico in San Francisco, and you can find his recipe for draniki at splendidtable.org. And I have to tell you, after he left that night, I made literally 10 more of them for me and my wife and our little daughter, and our house smelled like it for 2 days, and it made me so happy. And speaking of oil,
champagne goes well with anything fried because you have this acidity and you have the bubbles that cut through the richness. Like fried chicken and champagne is one of the great, you know, food and wine pairings of the world.
That's Peter Leem, who wants you to drink more champagne. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. You're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters, and I'm your host, Francis Lamb. We are definitely not in the business of doing annual gift guides, but we do have a few things this year we think you should keep in mind when you're writing your wish list. One is a terrific new cookbook called Season by Nick Sharma. It's a super personal book about being a gay Indian immigrant, but he uses these powerhouse flavors to connect us to his story. And Nick talked about it with our friend Russ Parsons.
Nick Sharma, it's so great to have you here today.
Hi, Russ. Thank you for having me here today.
Now, you were raised in India and you moved to the United States as an adult, and you seem to have instinctively adapted the flavors of your home to the dishes of your adopted country. And your partner's from the South, and so there's this really interesting adaptation of Indian spicing to Southern technique.
Right. My husband Michael's from the South. His family lives on a farm right on the border of Virginia and North Carolina, and the food that they eat It's interesting. It reminds me of some of the dishes that I grew up with in India, but in a very different way. You know, like biscuits, for example, right? Like biscuits, you use fat to kind of create that flaky texture. And then you have parathas, which are cooked in India. And you use fat again there in the dough. You cut it through to give a flaky texture to the flatbread. So I started noticing a lot of these little nuances in cooking techniques as well as the food that was being cooked. Okra. Okra is big in the South. My husband loves okra. Okra is big in India too. And then spices. This is something that I've noticed, that a lot of countries where people are in warmer climates, they tend to use a lot of spices. And they do that in the South as well. And so it just seemed natural to kind of bring those flavors in, do it in my own way. And the good thing is, most recipes are amenable to manipulation, depending on how you do it.
You know, that kind of culinary adaptation can be a real tightrope walk. There have been so many bad examples of bad fusion food. What were the most important lessons you learned that allowed you to marry these different cuisines so effectively?
So when I cook, I really don't cook for a restaurant. So I'm not really looking to impress people. I'm not really looking to plate beautifully. I'm just looking to cook things that I think I would like to eat, my husband would like to eat, my friends would like to eat, my family would like to eat. And then, of course, for the home cooks. So I'm looking just to play with flavor in the kitchen, and I'm not really looking to do something on a more ambassadorial scale and, you know, build things in different layers. I do flavor in layers, but I'm not really looking to make multiple components at a meal. And at the end of the day, I think that a dish is strong when it tastes good and it's cooked well. And I'm coming always from the home cook's perspective. So I think it's a much different audience that I'm trying to connect with.
How deep does the adaptation go? When you feel a need for comfort food, for example,
sure,
do you turn to traditional Indian dishes that you grew up with, or the American dishes that you've learned to love, or is it a combination of two?
It's definitely a little bit of both. So it's definitely, of course, what I want to eat at the moment. It's not necessarily always Indian, and it's not necessarily always American, but it's what's around me. I feel that having grown up in both these countries now as an adult, and hopefully a much more mature one, the thing that I want to do is have both of them with me. And so often there are things like, I'll give you an example, rice pudding, right? I feel like every country has a rice pudding of some sort. India has two types. There's kheer and then there's firni, which is a ground rice flour kind of pudding. And then there's the whole rice grain, which is kheer. And then you come to America and then there's rice pudding here too. And so, you know, it's easy to draw in those spices and those flavors. And those are the things that matter to me at the end of the day. Like, I want it to taste good. I'm really not looking to say this is traditional or this is not. I always stay away from that because I feel that's not what I'm looking to do. And that's where I always come from, that should it taste good? Does it taste good? Will it execute well? And will I eat it at the end of the day? And of course, will others want to eat it?
Photography is so important to your work. You started as a blogger. You have a very distinctive look. How did you develop that signature visual style?
Okay, so of course, I didn't start out that way. I was photographing like pretty much all food media does. So, you know, I was learning how to play with light. And then I also realized a lot of my photos were just looking like everyone else's. At the same time, I love to cook. And one of the things I really want to do was kind of showcase not only the final dishes or the ingredients that you commonly see, but also the process of cooking. And I wanted to do it in my own way. And I always think about these things happening like it's a ballerina on stage and the spotlight is only on her, which is why I cut out a lot of the light in my photos, because the focus is then just happening only on the process or the food at that point. And everything else is noise and falls aside. I also use my hands. Another reason why I do that is because I want photos to be instructional, so people are attracted to them. But I feel sometimes, especially with more complicated recipes that involve a lot of technique, it's easier to remember things when they're visually happening. It acts as a better guide than words. And then one of the things, having worked in a kitchen, you know, I've always wanted to kind of represent people who don't look or sound like everyone else. You don't see these people in the front of the kitchen. And that was something that I really wanted to do and give them a voice through just showing my hands in the photos. One of the things when I started out with blogging and even photographing for print journals and magazines, I really didn't find a space for myself. A lot of the mainstream food media was pretty much, focused on white people. And I didn't really know if there was something that I could share because I didn't feel like I was a part of it. And then having worked in a kitchen, I would work with people that were from all over the country. So you'd have all over the world, actually. So you'd have people who were immigrants, people who grew up here. Some were from Asia, some were from the Middle East, some were from Iran, some were from India, like me. And I'd never see them in front of the restaurant. And so that kind of made me wonder why this representation was never there, because these are the people actually producing the food for us to eat. And so when I started to photograph food, my skin is brown, so I really couldn't change anything. And so that was a way when I said, oh, I'm going to like do these instructional photos. This became a way for me to kind of give them a voice in a much more subtle way. I was trying to do my bit to kind of represent the people that I worked with. So hopefully kids that kind of want to get into this field and don't look like or sound like people that are already in it and well-established, they kind of feel like they have a place in there. And that was something that I was missing, and I hope that my work kind of gives them that.
That's such an important point, and it's so easy to overlook. Nick Sharma, thank you so much for being on Splendid Table and talking to us.
Thank you for having me, Russ. It was great to be here.
Nick Sharma's book is called Season, Big Flavors, Beautiful Food, and he writes a column for the San Francisco Chronicle. Russ Parsons' latest book is called How to Pick a Peach. And in the spirit of giving, Nick left us with a whole bunch of recipes. Hot green chutney roasted chicken, a ginger lentil millet bowl, and his spiced meatloaf. And they're all at splendidtable.org. Gifting is really one of the great, truest joys of life. But, I mean, look, it's stressful. It's lines at the cashier. It's, you know, my wife and I spent literally 2 hours trying to write our holiday card list last night. And sometimes it is really no fun and you just want a drink after. Well, it's champagne season, so that worked out well. And the wine writer Peter Leem thinks it's time for you to open that bottle for yourself. And to do it all 12 months of the year, honestly. He's so obsessed with champagne that he moved to the region called Champagne to study it. And he talked with Melissa Clark about how versatile it can be and why you don't need special glasses for it.
Peter, so great to have you here.
Thank you, Melissa.
So people think of champagne as something to drink for a celebration or, you know, for the new year. But champagne is delicious and we should be drinking it more often. Why do you think people just relegate it to this special thing? Is it expense or...
No, I think this is absolutely true. I think historically, we haven't treated champagne as a real wine. Champagne is culturally so heavily linked with celebration, and some people forget that champagne, in fact, it's a wine like any other. It's made from grapes. In fact, it's made as a still wine before the sparkle gets put in it, And it hasn't been until very recently that we've begun to think about champagne like other wines.
Now, like other wines, champagne pairs really well with some things and maybe not so well with others. How do you like to serve champagne with meals?
Well, champagne, in fact, is an excellent pairing with food. Champagne, because of its high acidity and its relatively low alcohol, and also because of the bubbles, the effervescence contributes to making it pair with a wide variety of things. Also, champagne is extremely diverse. We tend to think of champagne as just wine with bubbles. But in fact, like the diversity of still wine, champagne comes in all sorts of weights and flavors and styles. And so you can really find champagne to pair with just about anything.
Okay, talk to me about the different styles of champagne, because I think that's true. I think we all think of champagne as sort of one thing. Mm-hmm. So what are the different styles? What should people look for?
Well, to begin with, champagne is made out of three principal grape varieties. So one of them is white, Chardonnay, and the other two are red grapes, Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier. And so champagne can be made out of one of these or a blend of these, you know, and so each of these grapes have different characteristics. You know, Chardonnay tends to be lighter in body. It tends to be higher in acidity. Pinot Noir is richer and rounder. And so different houses or different producers will use these varieties to achieve different ends.
And so if we wanted to get a champagne that was, say, all, we wanted a lighter style, maybe that would be all Chardonnay. And
sometimes,
that's the Blanc de Blanc. Is that how? So tell us about the label. So how do we know what we're getting in each bottle?
Well, most champagne will simply say something like Brut.
Okay.
Which is actually a sweetness designation. So it's Brut is essentially a dry champagne. Beyond that, you might see some other names like Blanc de Blanc, for example, which means that it's made entirely of white grapes, which almost always means that it's made entirely of Chardonnay. The red grape counterpart of that is Blanc de Noir, which isn't as common, but we're seeing it more. Other than that, it's difficult to know what the precise blend of a champagne is. And honestly, it doesn't necessarily even matter. Champagne is blended not only from different grape varieties, but also different terroirs, because champagne is quite a large appellation. And so most producers are blending from different vineyards all over the region. And these all give you different characteristics too. And so with major brands or, you know, major houses, when you have a blend that comes from across the region like that, then you're looking more at the style of the house. You know, mm-hmm. So for example, like Krug or Paul Roger might make richer, fuller-bodied wines, whereas like Tattinger or Laurent Perrier might make lighter-bodied wines.
Right. So you really need to talk to the person selling you the wine to kind of understand what's in the bottle.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now let's go back to the food, though. So, what are some of your favorite ways to pair champagne with food, with meals?
Well, champagne pairs really well with anything umami, anything savory. Champagne, because of the way that it's made, it ages for a long time on its lees, on its yeasts, and this contributes an umami character to champagne itself.
That toasty, nutty flavor we get with champagne.
Yeah, this kind of savory, you know, these savory undertones. And also, champagne, because it's grown in chalk, it can sometimes be downright salty. And so, you know, some classic pairings, you know, with champagne are like mushrooms, for example, you know, because you have this umami action, you know.
So like pasta with mushrooms, risotto absolutely. With mushrooms.
Yeah, I mean, that's superb. Mushrooms, truffles, so, you know, anything like that. Champagne is excellent with Japanese food because of this. Champagne goes well with anything fried, because you have this acidity and you have the bubbles that you know cut through the richness.
A little more elegant than a beer. Like same kind of, you know,
exactly.
effervescence.
Exactly. Like fried chicken and champagne is one of the great, you know, food and wine pairings of the world.
Not what people would think. But maybe not a steak, or would you do it with steak?
In fact, with fuller-bodied champagnes, Pinot Noir heavy champagnes, you can actually find champagnes that are rich enough and that have enough body to pair with meat.
Okay, now here's a question for you. I open a bottle of champagne and I don't finish it. Mm-hmm. Can I save the rest of it, or is it
absolutely? So you can get special champagne stoppers that will keep
and those work
and they work very well. I do it at home all the time. In fact, typically when I'm at home, I'll open a bottle of champagne and drink it over 2 or 3 days.
Okay,
and especially with younger champagne, oftentimes it's even better on the second day because it's had time to get a little more air and kind of open up. And so you can certainly keep a champagne in the fridge for a day or two without a problem.
Now, how do you like to serve champagne, flutes or wine glasses?
I'm very much a fan of wine glasses. I think that, you know, flutes give you this really elegant picture of the bubbles, but they don't do many favors for the wine itself. I always advocate, you know, serving champagne in a white wine glass of some sort. It allows you to perceive more of the aromas and more of the flavors.
And what about the temperature? Should it be straight from the fridge?
I always prefer to serve it not too cold.
Okay.
I think this is a common thing in restaurants around the world, is that champagne is served really ice cold. And that also inhibits your perception of the wine.
Peter, thank you so much. This was fascinating. Now I need to go drink some champagne.
Thank you.
Peter Leem is the author of the James Beard Award-winning book, Champagne, The Essential Guide to the Wines, Producers, and Terroir of the Iconic Region. And even if you don't buy it, really, find it in a bookstore and just look at it, because it is a ridiculously beautiful thing. Melissa Clark is the author of pretty much every cookbook you'll ever need, but her latest is called Comfort in an Instant. And at splendidtable.org, you can find some of Peter's recommendations to help you track down a great bottle of champagne. Coming up, your calls and the gift you might want to approach with caution.
We quickly discovered that air fryer is not exactly, well, it's a little bit misleading.
That's Lisa McManus with America's Test Kitchen. And I'm Francis Lamb with The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. All right, it's time for you and me to talk. 1-800-537-5252, or you can find us on social media, or email us, contact@splendidtable.org. Let us know what you're working on in the kitchen, or what you're trying to figure out. And we have Madison on the line. Hey, Madison, how are you?
Hi, I'm well. How are you, Francis?
I'm well, thanks.
Well, I'm very excited to talk to you because I have been experimenting with lard in my cooking and baking. A few weeks ago, I was going through my grandmother's old recipe box that I inherited a few years ago, and several recipes call for lard specifically, and so I got really interested in what's the difference between lard and vegetable shortening, and I couldn't find any rendered lard in town, so I ended up buying a whole leaf lard from a meat market down the street from me that's really wonderful, Gartner's Meat Market. And I taught myself how to render lard.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it was really fun and really stinky. My roommates kind of asked me, hey, if you do that again, please tell us. They were very nice about it, but they were also like, ooh.
It does smell pretty swiney pretty quick.
Oh, yes. I had to put a fan in the window. It was a little much. But yeah, I ended up with about 2 jars of really beautiful, creamy, white lard and a Tupperware full of crackling that I have absolutely zero idea what to do with. So I was hoping you could help me out with figuring out how to use this crackling and some of this lard.
Sure. Well, I mean, the first thing, like, I think you kind of mentioned this already, but the first thing I would think about with that lard is use it in your pie crust. I mean, a lard crust... You can also cut it with butter if maybe the flavor is a bit much. I mean, I don't know that many people would be like, "Whoa, this is too much deliciousness." But you can cut it with butter. It makes for such a beautifully tender pie crust. Like, you know, be a little concerned, be light with your hand, and don't overmix and all that stuff. It doesn't like it's not like a fail safe. But the way it interacts with the flour is really beautiful. It makes it really tender. So I would definitely try that, and it has such a rich sort of mouth coating flavor.
Yes, I was really enjoying that. Now, I did make a couple apple pies with it already, and I had this funny issue where maybe I didn't cut the butter in enough, but after it baked, these little like cave-like holes kind of opened up in my crust.
Yeah, that might be a butter thing. It may be that the butter melted and then there's a hole and then there's there's water in the butter as well, which the lard shouldn't have if it's fully rendered, which then steams and helps to like puff the dough a little bit, puff the crust a little bit. But if there's, maybe if the butter is too big, then it doesn't like, fully interact with the flour and it kind of like melts and disappears. And sometimes you do end up with a hole, but like I said, it's not like anyone's complaining. I see the cracklins. I mean, so you bring up a good point. You rendered this from a leaf lard. Cracklins from something, if you're rendering from, say, like back fat or something that has some skin or something like that, those cracklins tend to be really crunchy or can be really crunchy. Whereas I think the cracklins from a leaf lard will be really light and delicate, right? Like almost like puffed and aerated.
Yeah, they're almost like a fat version of punkel. And after I squeezed all the lard out through the cheesecloth, they were still kind of soft, so I spread them out on a baking pan and popped them in the oven for a little while longer to try to dry them out a little more.
Yeah.
Sprinkled a little salt and pepper to test when I got them out, and that would be dangerous finger food right there because it was pretty flavorful by itself. But I mean, it's so rich that I don't want to just sit there and that would be kind of gross to just sit there and eat pork
crackling.
Just
eat them. I
figured I could use it like as a garnish or something.
Exactly. That's exactly what I would say to do. And you know what you could do, which would be super delicious, is top a pasta with a few spoonfuls of it. So you have that beautiful texture, that sort of light, crisp crunch, that beautiful, rich flavor is going to sort of, you know, work its way through as you're eating it. If you feel like it's maybe too rich, you could cut it with really nice toasted breadcrumbs and toast in maybe, I don't know, half and half, you know, whatever ratio feels right to you and your cardiologist, and, you know, sprinkle that on top of your pasta. I could also see it with, you know, just simple things. So you feature it, you know, a salad.
Yeah, maybe like replacing half the breadcrumbs of a casserole top with crackling.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Ooh.
A casserole if it's already rich, then like it's a rich on rich. I could see it with like a nice salad, right? So the salad is going to be light. It's going to be vinaigrette. And you'll just have that really nice crunch in it spread all throughout. That's sort of unexpected as a texture, but also will give more body to the salad. You know, like simple greens or maybe heartier greens, maybe even like romaine or something. Like, you know, thinking like Caesar salad. Like Caesar salad, you have that really hearty green and you have those like nice croutons. Instead of big croutons, just sprinkle some of these cracklings, maybe again cut with some nice toasted breadcrumbs, and that could be so delicious.
Wow, how many hours is it till lunch? That sounds amazing. Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for the call. I hope you enjoy your lard. I'm glad you made it.
I certainly will.
Yeah. And take care.
You too. Thank you so much, Francis. You've given me so many great ideas.
I'm glad. Thanks for the call.
Thanks. Bye.
All right. We have Sam calling from St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Sam.
Hi, Francis. So the question that I have is, a lot of the side dishes that I like to make at home for dinners or things like that, when we have a big holiday celebration, sometimes we've had like 20 to 40 people, and I'm wondering, how can I get a side dish recipe to magnify or quantify up, ramp up to a big party without throwing things off balance? Because like sometimes if I just, you know, amplify the seasoning by that factor to get the right number, the seasoning's off, it's too salty or not salty enough, or the spicing can be weird.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so the question is, if the recipe says, you know, serves four, and you typically find that it serves four just fine, but now you have 20 people coming over, why is it that you can't just multiply everything by five and have it turn out well?
Exactly.
And, you know, it's weird. It really is weird. Some recipes scale up perfectly from zero to infinity.
Right.
And some don't. And to be honest, I don't really know why that is. Part of it, a big part of it, especially if you're talking about seasoning and spicing amounts, is that, you know, if I say to you, here, half a teaspoon of, you know, cumin or whatever, and you take your little measuring spoon, you get a half a teaspoon, well, it's never really half a teaspoon, right? It's like maybe a little bit mounded, so it's half a teaspoon plus a little more, or maybe you didn't dip all the way in the jar, so it's half a teaspoon minus some. But over the course of whatever that amount is, it's generally fine. Now, you do it five times over, right? And that little mounding of the half teaspoon adds up. And so now you've added six times the amount that you meant to add instead of five times. You know what I mean? Sometimes that kind of thing happens, which is why every single chef and author, cookbook author, is like, when will people just use weights and use grams? And because it's always 25 grams times five is always 125 grams, you know?
Right. So like if I break out the kitchen scale and like measured that quarter teaspoon of cumin on the scale did the math, would that help set me straight?
Probably, but then it still all depends on like how well did you measure that first half teaspoon, right? So, okay. So let's not get too crazy about that. I mean, honestly, like if you want to be very precise about it, that is probably not a bad way to go. But without getting too crazy about it, what I would say is this. I would try to measure everything, multiply by whatever amount that you want to multiply by, and just taste it. Like, you know, don't trust that the recipe will magnify the same way. Taste it as you go along. Maybe hold back a little bit of the seasoning as you're seasoning. Taste it. Hey, does it taste all right? Okay, cool. Add it back in. You know what I mean? Like, you know, suggest like hold off on adding all of it. Taste it. Then add the rest if you feel like you need it. Taste it again. Add a little more if you feel like you need that. You just kind of play with it a little bit more. The other thing I would say that's, to my mind, the tricky part about scaling a lot of recipes up is that you now have a temptation to crowd the pan. If you're searing something, and usually, you know, we always say when you're searing something, give it ample room in the pan so, you know, it browns nicely, or, you know, but, you know, I don't want to do it 8 times, so I'm going to try to stuff more onto the pan. And the fact of the matter is, if you're not getting the same level of browning, you're not giving the same level of, like, you know, I hate to say it, but attention and care to every single bite, it's kind of not going to taste the same in the end. So it is important to cook in batches, and sometimes it will take kind of a lot longer. But if you want to get that same level of flavor, if you're like browning the onions or you're slow caramelizing the onions and normally it takes you just a few minutes, well, now it might take you 45 minutes to brown all all those onions to the same level. So it's part of it is multiplying the ingredients, but I think a big part of it is multiplying the time. Don't crowd your pans and know that you're cooking for 20 people you really like a lot, so it's worth it.
Right. Yeah, we did this for like a hunter stew once, and I tried to brown all the sides of the cube meat before we threw it in the 4 different crock pots and the oven to slow cook overnight. And that process and like, took like 2 hours instead of the like 20 minutes.
Yeah. You know, and it's like, if you want to get the same flavor, you kind of have to do it that way.
Okay.
I don't know of a good trick. I mean, sometimes you can do things where like, okay, we'll throw this under the broiler. So you can do it on a sheet pan instead of a saute pan, right?
Okay.
So you can get some browning that way. You know, there are tricks you can do, but the overall point is you gotta get the stuff cooked right. You know, you gotta get the sauces reduced. You gotta get the meats browned. You gotta get the color. Everything should be done to the same level. It sometimes takes more time than you expect.
Okay, cool. All right, well,
again,
wish me luck.
You're doing it for people you really care about.
Right.
Just think of like your friends' smiling faces the whole time you're like getting grease splattered.
Maybe I'll just like Facebook Live the whole process so that they can see how much I care, and then maybe if it falls short, they can at least know the amount of effort that actually went into it.
Yeah. And keep right, you guys are bringing the wine, right?
Right, exactly. And it better be a lot. All right, great. Have a happy holidays.
You too. Take care.
Bye.
Remember, you can get to us anytime. Leave a voicemail, 1-800-537-5252. If the last couple years have been the age of the Instant Pot, there is a new countertop convenience cooking appliance in town. The air fryer. People are getting obsessed with air fryers. I can't swing a chicken cutlet in my office without hitting a new air fryer cookbook. So you might be thinking about getting one for this holiday season, but when the folks at America's Test Kitchen set out to test them, well, Lisa McManus did her best to be diplomatic about it, I guess. Here she is explaining to Sally Swift exactly what they are.
Well, they're countertop appliances that promise to produce perfectly fried food very quickly and with very little oil, which sounds great, right?
Yeah, it sounds perfect.
Well, the reality is a little bit different. We tested 9 different models, and they're not cheap. They're $60 to $250. And we tried them on all kinds of, you know, fried foods that you might want to do, you know, in a lighter way, like French fries or chicken wings and chicken parm. We quickly discovered that air fryer is not exactly, well, it's a little bit misleading.
So what are they if they're not fryers?
Well, they're more like a convection oven. They don't fry, because frying really is when you have hot oil contacting the food, and the heat transfers through that hot oil much more quickly than it does through air. So that gives you that crisp crust and that juicy, just cooked food inside. It doesn't let the food dry out before you get that beautiful crust on the outside. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, fat tastes great, so it adds a lot of richness. These, because they're doing very little oil, stands to reason, they taste a lot leaner, like you had oven fried things. So that's kind of the standard we ended up comparing them to. How do they taste compared to food that you oven fried on a sheet tray with maybe a wire rack?
And what did you find?
Well, you know, most of them made comparable food to what you could get on a sheet pan with a wire rack in your oven. Which sort of begs the question, do you actually need to buy mm-hmm. this thing? Because some of these are a foot and a half wide and, you know, 20 inches high, and they're big, you know, and they're yeah. and they're not cheap. So we were sort of like, well, you know, and some of them were pretty confusing to use. They had lots of dials and buttons, and, you know, if you bumped them, the settings would change, and, you know, they were not perfect, most of them. But we actually liked several of them for what they were. And, you know, at the end, we could kind of recommend one or two of them.
Well, I want to back up a minute, because these things don't hold very much food either, do they?
No, and that was a big surprise and a bit of a drawback for, you know, normal size, like, I don't want to say normal, but larger portions. You know, if you're not cooking for one or two people, you're going to be standing there all day like a short order cook with this little thing. They're big machines. You know, the ones we liked had these drawers in the front that you could just pull the drawer out, and it's like a little fry basket. And you throw the food in there and push it back in and set the controls on the top. And it whirs around this hot air and cooks the food through convection, which is just circulating hot air around that food in a little basket. You can't really cook for a large family with this.
Mm-hmm. So if you're cooking for two people, or you have a teenager at home for after school snacks or something, this might be the right thing, right?
Yeah. I mean, it also preheats very, it doesn't really require preheating like your oven. It cooks, you know, very quickly. So, I mean, not significantly faster than the oven, mm-hmm. but a little bit, and you don't have to preheat. They also don't get hot on the outside. So if you're trying to do one or two portions, say in the summer, and you just don't want to heat up your whole oven, not a bad choice. And another nice function is a lot of them turn themselves off when they're done cooking. So, you know, if you are one of those people who starts cooking some food and then the smoke alarm goes off, this might be a good choice. They're not entirely hands off. You do have to stop and shake the food around and get that air to circulate. But, you know, they're pretty straightforward to use if you pick the right ones.
And which did you guys pick?
Well, our favorite, unfortunately, was the most expensive one at $250, but it works great for what it is, and it's called the Philips TurboStar Air Fryer Advanced Digital. It has sort of a smaller profile, had automatic shutoff, it was easy to clean, and the controls are really intuitive.
And is there anything less expensive than that?
Yeah, well, it's more affordable. It's called the GoWise USA 3.7 quart 7-in-1 air fryer. It's about $75. It's our best buy. It's a little bit less intuitive, but it works quite well.
Okay, well, it sounds to me like you guys really did your work. Thanks, Lisa, for coming in and reporting.
Thanks for having me.
Lisa McManus heads up the ingredient and equipment testing for America's Test Kitchen. You can find a list of the air fryers they do recommend at splendidtable.org. And that is our show for the week. Sorry to end it on a downer about those air fryers, but hey, holiday time is real talk time. That's not a thing. No one actually says that. Okay. We'll see you next week. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media. And our website, splendidtable.org, is home to many things. You can search our recipe library, register for a weekly newsletter, Week Night Kitchen, check out our videos from Renee Redzepi to Kristen McGlory of Food 52 to Jacques Pepin, and last but not least, subscribe to our podcasts, wherever you get yours. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell, Jenny Lupke is our editor and technical director, Erica Romero is our assistant producer, Chip Walton is our digital associate producer, and Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in, and happy holiday season. I'm Francis Lam, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.